We all know that Israel has been excellent in milking the history and the memory of the Holocaust. They have had reparations that are still being paid, by the way, by the German Republic. And those reparations helped to build the destructive capacity of Israel. The Israeli atom bombs and the military-industrial complex were financed by those reparations. That was the main areas that benefited. They made a lot of political capital, allowing Israel control of Western politicians and the U.S. and other political systems. And we can see that in the last 2.5 years very clearly. It allowed them to control the Holocaust narrative. It also confirmed Israel as the collective Jewish victim of the global anti-Semitism, an anti-Semitism that actually stopped existing for a while. And it also turned the IHRA, the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, into the global tool of fighting criticism against Israel. In preparation for this meeting, I spent 2 days online trying to find any mention of the genocide in Gaza on the 100 or so websites of Holocaust museums, libraries, research centers, study centers, etc. There are about 100 of them. And after 2 days, I found nothing apart from one miserable sentence in one of the websites. The Holocaust of the Palestinians, the genocide in Gaza, does not exist. You understand, of course, that all these institutions claim to be against genocide and to use their facilities and websites, etc., to fight against genocides and everywhere. The genocide in Gaza is totally missing. So this is a story of total denial of the one genocide which is now taking place by all the centers that are run by Zionists who are denying this genocide. I will now ask Rania Halik to start the webinar with her presentation. Rania is a Lebanese-American journalist, host of Breakthrough News, a contributor to The Nation, to The Gray Zone, to The Intercept, and many others. Rania, the stage is yours.
Well, thank you so much. And it's once again an honor to be alongside some incredibly wonderful and brilliant people, some of whom I've had the honor of hosting on my show on Breakthrough News. Once again, for a Holocaust Memorial or Holocaust Remembrance Day panel where we can talk about the genocide that is still being denied in Gaza, which we're now more than 2 years into. I mean, I can't believe it's been more than 2 years of genocide in Gaza. The horrors are still continuing, but they become so normalized that they don't shock anyone anymore. And what we're witnessing now at this point is the most aggressive, coordinated genocide denial campaign, I think, in the history of genocide denial. It's an industry, one that includes governments and major media institutions, tech platforms, universities, legal systems. And it's devoted not only to denying that a genocide is happening, but to justifying it, to normalizing it, and increasingly to punishing anyone who dissents. That should, of course, matter profoundly at a Holocaust Remembrance Day panel, because genocide doesn't only require perpetrators. We know that it requires enablers and lies and the silencing of those who refuse to go along. And since, you know, October 2023, Israel has carried out mass civilian slaughter on an industrial scale, live streamed for everyone to watch. Entire bloodlines have been erased. More than 2,700 Palestinian families wiped out. That was recently reported. The true death toll, none of us really know what it is. It's certainly far higher than the official figures, and maybe in the hundreds of thousands. And yet, instead of, you know, reckoning with this reality, we've been subjected to a relentless campaign of fabrication since the beginning. We're told that Hamas beheaded babies, that there was mass rape campaigns, and none of that ever happened. Those claims collapsed under scrutiny quite quickly, yet they're still repeated. What has happened, documented repeatedly by human rights organizations, by people on the ground, is the intentional killing of Palestinian children, of Palestinian babies, the use of starvation as a weapon, the systematic torture and sexual abuse of Palestinian detainees. That's where the rape is happening. The Israelis are the ones doing the raping. Reality, though, has been inverted, and the victim is made into the criminal, and the crime itself is reframed as self-defense. I mean, we've all gotten used to this script because much of the Western media has functioned not as a check on power, but as an accomplice, you know, laundering these lies that make mass death acceptable. And that brings me to, you know, I think what we probably all agree to with at this point, which is that Zionism as a political project of ethnic supremacy enforced through permanent war and genocide at this point it's a death cult. It mirrors the very logic that once targeted Jews during the Holocaust, the collective punishment, the racial hierarchy, the idea that, you know, some lives are expendable for the security and supremacy of others. And of course, we always have to be precise, right? This isn't the Jews. It's not simply Israel acting alone. It's definitely not the Jews, despite what so many Zionist organizations in America keep saying, by the way. But it's also not simply that Israel is leading this on its own or acting alone. And I think that's an important point to clarify here. Israel is a powerful partner of U.S. imperialism. Israel functions as the spearhead of American imperial power in the Middle East. And it may seem like obvious to some of us, but I say this because it's become increasingly popular, especially in U.S. analyst circles across the political spectrum, to try to frame this as like Israel's always just dragging the U.S. into enabling and participating into all these atrocities from Palestine to Iran. But that's just not the case. It enjoys total impunity because it's a partner of American imperial power. That's why it can get away with murder. And this is not, you know, this is not a story of Israel secretly controlling the U.S. That narrative really, it annoys me because it lets the U.S. off the hook. This is a story of American imperialism operating at full capacity. Gaza represents hyper-imperialism. It's the most extreme expression of the U.S.-led global order and how far it's willing to go to maintain its dominance. And it's really raised the threshold for what's allowed now. And once, you know, once that threshold is crossed, it can't stay contained. That's why they went after Lebanon, trying to crush Hezbollah. That's why they attacked Yemen, going after the Houthis, because they dared to stand up to Israel and the U.S. That's why they attacked Cuba. That's why they kidnapped the president of Venezuela. And that's why they're preparing to attack Iran. Again, Gaza is the blueprint. And history tells us that blueprints for mass violence are never retired voluntarily. They're only dismantled through resistance. And I want to also just to go back to the Israel issue here. Obviously, there can be no justice without a denazification of Israeli society, which I've heard many of you all talk about before. This is central to justice for Palestinians. It's central to any future beyond genocide. And I think it's inseparable from dismantling the settler colonial project that defines the Israeli state as it exists today. Because obviously a society that teaches its children that another people are subhuman, that collective punishment is normal and okay, and that extermination is self-defense, isn't just a political problem. It's a moral catastrophe. But that kind of denazification, I don't think it can stop at Israel. Because again, this is not only an Israeli pathology. It is an imperialist mentality, and it infects the entire system that rules the world with the U.S. at its helm. You know, it's like, what does a free Palestine mean in a world where the U.S. still bombs countries into rubble, where it collapses states through sanctions designed to starve civilian populations, where it destroys any society that refuses to submit to imperial dominance. And, you know, if there was a free Palestine, it would be immediately destroyed by American imperialism, because a free Palestine would refuse to submit to imperial dominance. What does never again mean if Gaza can happen again somewhere else under a different name with a different justification to a different people? If we're serious about preventing genocide, then denazification has to be understood, I think, more broadly. It means dismantling the ideologies of supremacy and entitlement and domination that make genocide possible in the first place. And that means dismantling imperialism itself, because Gaza isn't just a massive crime, it's a warning. And I actually want to just briefly say something about Iran, because propaganda is already doing its preparatory work. And, you know, we don't have to love the Iranian government. We don't have to endorse the Islamic Republic. What we do have to recognize is this script that's taking place right now, because we've seen it over and over again. It's a regime change playbook. It first comes with sanctions designed not to protect human rights, but to destroy an economy, to immiserate a population, and to generate unrest. And when people protest, as they have every right to do, that unrest can then be hijacked. We've heard Israeli intelligence admitting to this. We've heard the Shah's son admitting to this. We've heard U.S. officials admitting to this. Chaos is stoked. Violence is escalated. And then the inevitable response from the security state is used to justify intervention. We watched this happen in Libya. We watched it happen in Syria. We've seen it happen across Latin America. And we've actually seen parts of this play out in Iran before. So we need to be deeply skeptical of the narratives coming out of Washington and the State Department and the Israeli government right now, especially when we're asked to believe claims so absurd they collapse under basic scrutiny. And I'm talking about these numbers we're hearing now of like 40, 50,000 Iranians killed in like 48 hours. I mean, think about that. We're supposed to believe that in 2 days, Iran killed more people than Israel slaughtered in Gaza in more than 2 years. I mean, give me a break. But pointing this out again does not require loyalty to the Iranian government. It just requires intellectual honesty and a refusal to be manipulated into supporting another imperialist destruction of yet another country. Because these governments in the West do not care about human rights. They carry out street executions through immigration enforcement in American cities, as we all saw the U.S. do over the weekend to Alex Preti. They imprison dissidents at homes. They bankroll absolute monarchies that rely on slave labor and crush political opposition all across the Middle East. They do not care about Iran's people. They care about oil. They care about dominance. And they care about destroying any state that refuses full submission to imperial power. And as that violence escalates abroad, I think we're all witnessing something happening at home and in the Western countries that we live in. You know, the ruling class is consolidating control over the narrative because they have to. I mean, we're watching billionaires swallow media platforms, creating this billionaire-owned media ecosystem designed to suppress dissent and gaslight the public. They have to control the narrative because the reality in front of us is too horrific to justify on its own. And that's when they also have to ramp up the right-wing populism, what's actually just fascism. They tell people to hate immigrants so they don't have notice that they have no savings. They tell people to fear outsiders so they don't ask why they have to work two jobs and still can't survive. They distract people with manufactured culture wars while their tax dollars fund endless wars and go to corporations so they can loot resources from the global South. And then here's, of course, where Holocaust remembrance, I think, becomes especially urgent, because there's this horrific irony in the fact that many of the institutions, as you mentioned in the opening, many of the institutions that claim to be guardians of Holocaust memory are the ones that most aggressively weaponize that memory to justify the genocide in Gaza, to silence dissent, and to rationalize imperialist conquests even beyond Gaza. I mean, we watch them invoke the Holocaust, not to prevent genocide, but to literally excuse it, not to protect the vulnerable, but to shield the powerful. And, you know, every government the U.S. hates is run by Hitler. We have to prevent the next Hitler. And the Holocaust is always invoked against whoever the State Department enemy is. We can't allow them to monopolize how the Holocaust is remembered. And I think that's why we do panels like this, so that they can't. Because we're the ones who are remembering it the right way, not as this moral shield for empire, but as a warning, not as a justification for supremacy, but as a lesson to where supremacy leads. The lesson of the Holocaust is not that atrocities are inevitable. It's that they're enabled through propaganda, fear, silence, the criminalization of resistance. And, you know, yes.
2 minutes, Rania.
Yeah, got it. And that brings us, I think, to this moment for resistance, where it comes in many forms, whether it's in educating people, in the battle of ideas, which is where I like to place myself in that position as a media person, expose the lies, name the system, to refuse that moral confusion. It's a moment to organize, to protest, to be in the streets while we still have the right to be, to speak while speech is still legal, to assemble while assembly is still permitted. And it's questionable if speech is still legal. We all saw what happened to Tony at the beginning of this year. Because of course, you know, history, I know it's a cliche, but history shows us that these rights aren't taken all at once. They're eroded step by step, always in the name of security. And Palestine has always been the canary in the coal mine. I mean, who were the first people who were kidnapped last year by ICE in the US? It was students who protested against the genocide in Gaza. So never again has to mean dismantling that, not just, you know, the Israeli apartheid genocidal system, but the fascistic imperialist system that makes Gaza possible, so that Gaza never happens again, not just in Palestine, but anywhere to anyone. And I will leave it there since I've run out of time.
Thank you very much for sticking to the time. I'm going to introduce the next speaker. The speakers have a maximum of 12 minutes, so please try to stick to that timetable. Our next speaker is Professor Ilan Pape. He is a professor at Exeter University, author of Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and too many other books, I think about 20, that I cannot mention here. Ilan, the stage is yours. Ilan, you have to unmute yourself.
You are. Okay. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Good. Thank you, Chaim, for your introduction. Thank you, the organizers, for thinking of me in this wonderful panel. And I would go directly to my contribution, because I'm aware we are running a bit late. My parents were both German Jews who lost members of their families in that terrible chapter of the Nazi genocide. In Israel, today, there is very little reference to the International Remembrance Day, the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, because I think the main reason is that the only context in which official Israel media, political system, and so on are interested in that particular universal, more international remembrance of the day is only to repeat the allegation that opposing the genocide of the Palestinians is a new form of anti-Semitism. Israel prefers a day of remembrance that it controls, in which it conveys the twin messages that Zionism is the only guarantee against another Holocaust, and that the Palestinians and their allies are the new Nazis threatening Western civilization. Moreover, Israel refuses to universalize the Holocaust or the Holocaust memory, claiming it cannot be compared to genocides that preceded it or those that followed it. But anti-Zionist Jews, like our dear friend Tony in his excellent last book, and maybe that's a good moment to remember the late John Rose in his book, The Myths of Zionism, did not only offer an alternative Jewish remembrance of the Holocaust, but boldly pointed out to a much wider context in which mass killings of any group in modern history should be discussed, and that is to discuss it in an integrative, in a joint way, and not separately, for the sake of understanding better the human-made catastrophes that plague the world, ironically, in the age of enlightenment, modernization, and progress, the age we are still living in. The recent violence of the West and its allies, spreading now from the killing fields of Gaza to the American action in Venezuela and the threat to Cuba, brings to mind Eric Hobsbawm's seminal work, The Age of Extremes, the short 20th century, I think 1914-1991. This book begins with the age of catastrophe that the period Hobsbawm is talking about is between 1914 to 1945, between the beginning of the First World War to the end of the Second World War. And the world to extract, and Hobsbawm says that if the world wants to extract itself from the awful years of the catastrophe that was Western made, it would have to totally change its attitude to Western extremism, which is a very refreshing way of looking at the word extremism that in our mainstream media and political discourse refers only to Islamic extremism. Hobsbawm concluded his book with the following warning. It's just a few sentences. If humanity is to have a recognizable future, it cannot be by prolonging the past or the present. If we try to build the third millennium on that basis, we shall fail. And the price of failure, that is to say, the alternative to a changed society, is darkness. Indeed, if the age of catastrophe is re-emerging globally or in Palestine, Hobsbawm's gloominess will be validated, and the price of the failure, as he calls it, will be paid by many, among them the Palestinians. Only in a very short reference, Hobsbawm also includes Zionism as one of the extreme Western phenomena of that age. The worst phenomenon of that age, of course, for him, was Nazism. It was Jewish activists such as the late John Rose who paid attention to the fact that Zionism was born in the age of extremes, as did Nazism. Rose wrote, "Zionism is not the same as Nazism, though Zionism has and is capable of genocidal outbursts." He wrote it in the 1990s. "Zionism is rooted in the traditions of European imperialism. That truth alone is sufficient to serve urgent warning about the implications of Zionism's ruthless colonial ambitions in Palestine." Looking at Zionism as a product of the age of catastrophe through the lens of Hobsbawm's incisive analysis show how Zionism, instead of being a panacea of that age, is rather a product of that age that made the short 20th century so violent. But it is much more than that. Zionism exported to Palestine the age of catastrophe, disrupting a very different trajectory, unraveling in Palestine in the period that Hobsbawm calls the age of catastrophe, namely between 1914 and 1945. Palestine was not suffering from the age of catastrophe at the same time that Europe did. But that age brought very soon after it ended in Europe, the catastrophe to Palestine. At the age of catastrophe, despite the already limited presence of Zionism, the Palestinian society actually enjoyed an age of hope and prosperity. A new professional elite emerged in the cities of Palestine during the mandatory period, that is, the time of the British rule, which balanced the influence of Arab Ottoman notables. And in the rural areas, despite the colonialist British policy, new schools appeared, built and funded by the villagers, because the British government did not put any money into schools in Palestine during the mandate, while old feuds were settled after the troubled years of the 1936 revolt. Despite the British ban on establishing a Palestinian university while allowing the Zionist community to open two such universities, educated young Palestinians were able to continue their academic careers in Beirut, in Cairo, and further afield. For them, the hope was that the Western age of catastrophe will bypass them. But then came the Nakba, a catastrophe born out of the ideology and praxis of the Western age of catastrophe. The disruption of the positive leap forward can best be seen through demographic catastrophes. a local, mostly pastoral and rural society, had to endure during the Nakba, influx of refugees without any institutional help or proper infrastructure. Small towns all over historical Palestine had to absorb in few months refugees in numbers that were double and in some cases triple than the original population. Without an adequate infrastructure, a society rooted for centuries in its homeland was flooded at the time of the ethnic cleansing with this influx of refugees. West Gaza and North Gaza are now experiencing today in this kind of influx in a far worse situation than the one that existed in 1948, if this is at all possible. If you look at what today is the Gaza Strip or the West Bank, you see 80,000 people in Gaza in 1948 in the Gaza district enjoying the entry into what potentially should have been the age of progress for Palestine. And similarly, the 400,000 people living in what would become the West Bank. And imagine now how in few days in 1948, the 80,000 people who live in the Gaza district need to absorb and cater for 200,000 refugees with no government or institutional help and no external help until 1950. And the 400,000 in the West Bank receive within few months another 300,000 refugees where there is still chaos and no real government around. And again, international aid is slow in coming. All these refugees were robbed by Israel of all their possession and came with nothing to these two areas Israel decided not to occupy in 1948 until it did occupy them in 67. This is when the age of catastrophe reached the shores of Palestine, imported by the Zionist movement. It took a while for the Palestinians to realize that what Europe exported to their homeland. They did not close their homes for the early poor Jews who arrived in 1882, nor did they fight against the British when they occupied Palestine. In all their negotiations, first with the British and later with the international community, the Palestinian leadership asked for the two principles that were meant to help the world to extract itself from the age of catastrophe, democracy and self-determination. Both were denied to the Palestinians by the British and later by the United Nations pro-Zionist policies. Very late in the date, when dispossession of people not only from the lands but also from the workplace became widespread, the Palestinians responded with violence. And yet they shared the hope of the post-45 world, promised a new era of peace and prosperity led by the world that would put an end to colonialism and the violation of the basic rights of the colonized people. But the West did not consult the colonized world when it ultimately unilaterally decided the fate of Palestine in the end of the mandate. Palestine was not the only place betrayed by the post-45 era. The colonial empires, as well as the new American empire, hung violently to all the new possessions. Mass killings, the people there that in their efforts to maintain economic and strategic domination. Getting out of the age of extremes today is not only, as the West would have it, converting the Islamist extreme groups or rogue states in the global South. Much more urgent is to face the roots causes which allowed such organization and states to emerge, which are symptoms and not the cause for the present new age of catastrophe we live in. And one of the root causes, by no means the only one, but an important one, is the Western immunity to the Zionist project that brought that European age of catastrophe to Palestine and perpetuated it to our days. A democratic colonized Palestine is the only way of avoiding the danger so astutely Hobsbawm sent us in the concluding words of his seminal work. It will require a new understanding of where did the age emanated from and where can the effective antidote come from. This will end a chain that began with the genocide of millions of people by Western colonialism and the one that generated later on, or impressed actually, those who generated the genocide of millions of Europeans, including 6 million Jews, and spread genocide as a means for political goals in many parts of the world, including in Palestine. A different world does not have to emerge from Palestine, but its sacredness to all three major religions shows there is something very unique about that place that have been missing by the spilling over of the European catastrophe and extremes or age of catastrophe and extreme onto its soil. A
Ilan.
de-Zionized and decolonized Palestine will indicate a new age, otherwise the age of extremes and catastrophe will linger on, and we can see its effects, how it affects the globe as a whole, leading to ecological holocaust, economic and social catastrophes, and mass killings by cutting-edge weapons that seem to be as lethal, if not more, as nuclear weapons. The age Palestine hopefully will launch, a decolonized, a de-Zionist Palestine will launch, will make the world a better place, something the millions of people demonstrating in the last 2.5 years for Palestine realized when they went to the street and faced boldly and courageously governments and police that wanted the age of catastrophe and extreme to continue because it served them economically, strategically, and ideologically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ilan. Excellent. I want to present the next speaker, who is Dr. Radha Karmi. Dr. Radha Karmi is author of many books. I will mention only the recent One State, The Only Democratic Future, and also her great novel, Murjana. The stage is yours, Radha.
Right. Thank you, Haim, and my thanks to Tony Greenstein, who has yet again assembled this panel in order to talk about an incredibly important subject, the commemoration of Holocaust Day. Now, today, we are supposed to commemorate the destruction, what amounts to the destruction of European Jewry at the hands of the Nazis. But we also need to remember that today marks the start of the process of destruction of Palestine and its people. I believe that these two events have to be commemorated together. Very often, it struck me that the two issues, the fate of European Jewry at the hands of a European movement, Nazism, and the fate of the Palestinian people, which has been so serious and ongoing, and we don't know the future yet. These two issues should always have been unrelated. The issue of the Jews of Europe and the issue of the Arabs, the Arab world, the Arabs of Palestine should never have been made to relate to each other. Very often I have thought that had the Palestinians been in a position to know the future, the best thing they could have done would have been to not ever talk about Jews, not talk about the Jews as invaders, as people who came to colonize their country. They should have confined themselves to talking about invaders, colonists. Doesn't matter where they came from. As far as the Palestinians are concerned, what happened to their country would have provoked their anger, their misery, their unhappiness that they've had since 1948, no matter who was responsible. Whether it had been people from Chad, I don't know, who came and invaded Palestine and did all the things that we know that the Zionists did. For the Palestinians, it's the same. It's the same. The fact that the invaders and the colonists happen to be Jews from Europe is a detail. It's not fundamental. It's not fundamental. And I've always thought that if the Palestinians had been able to somehow make that distinction clear, that what they were against was being colonized, that what they were against was being invaded, no matter by whom, and not talk about Jews, because fatally it made them inextricably linked to the whole Jewish story, which is nothing to do with the Palestinians, but it is to do, it's everything to do with Europe, European history, European persecution of Jews, all the rest of it. Unfortunately, not being able to foretell that this would happen, the Palestinians found themselves dragged in to the inner workings, the psychology, the misery, the persecution, the difficult history of the people, nothing to do with them, nothing at all. However, that's what's happened. And if indeed Nazism had never occurred, there would be no Israel today. And the Zionists would have remained as a small, eccentric cult whom people were not particularly interested in. But unfortunately, we know that that is not how history panned out. And the reason that Palestine was chosen is that Zionism was focused on Palestine because it provided a very good motive for marketing the idea of Israel. I don't have to tell the audience or the panel about the connection with the Old Testament, etc., etc. So that was one reason why Palestine was chosen. And of course, the other reason was anti-Semitism in Europe, which was extremely grateful to have somewhere where it could deposit the Jews it did not want. So that, unfortunately, was what happened to the Palestinians. It doesn't stop us, of course, pointing out, and it's very important to do so, the similarities between the ideology of Nazism and Zionism. They're both affected or influenced by 19th century ideas, 19th century nationalism ideas. They're both talk of racial purity. They both have the aim of this superior race. And one of the reasons and one of the effects of the superior race ideology has been, of course, the treatment of Holocaust survivors in Israel, which is notorious, very well known, that they were not the right kind of Jew that belonged to the superior race. So they were ignored and they had a very unpleasant time. And of course, Nazism and Zionism both have a territorial focus. This is a land for a specific group of people in which they must live together, unpolluted by inferior races. And in the 1930s, of course, the aims of Zionism and Nazism were aligned. I don't have to remind a panel like this of the alignment of interests between the Zionists and the Nazis in the Havara Agreement of 1937, the fact that there was no Zionist revolt against Nazism, the idea of taking in into to emigrate into Palestine the right kind of Jew. And so on. So I come back to the fact that really the Palestinians suffer from having been in the place that they were in, which was pinpointed, sought after by people with an agenda, a nefarious agenda, to take the land over, to make it fit the marketing story they put forward to the world, and which convinced so many people. And of course, at the same time, it was a solution for European anti-Semitism. It was became clear by 1938 at the Evian Conference that nobody wanted the Jewish refugees. There was a sort of quota system where this was possibly something that could deal with the problem, but there was an unspoken agreement that they'd have to all be or most of them dumped in Palestine. I want to really, I don't want to go on much longer because I find this whole subject very painful. I really do. You know, the fact that there is a genocide in Gaza, the fact that the Palestinians have paid such a heavy price for these European crimes, fantasies, for Zionist aspirations. We've paid such a heavy price. And when I think about the genocide in Gaza, that should have put an end to all this nonsense. It should have been the last word to actually put the lid on Israel. It should have led to the dismantlement of the state of Israel, which has been responsible for such a long history of crimes. When I think about that, I cannot summon enthusiasm to talk about the Holocaust in that the Nazis perpetrated against the Jews. Not that it did not happen, not that it was not heinous, all those things. But that's not what we need to be talking about today. We need to talk about the Palestinian genocide, the Palestinian Holocaust. And the only thing we need to ask is, what are we going to do to stop it?
Thank you very much, Rada, for reminding us of the most important thing that we should be thinking, talking, writing, conversing about at this time. Tony, like the other speakers, doesn't need an introduction. He is a Jewish anti-Zionist activist. He's awaiting at the moment his case as a terrorist, like the rest of us, is now active at the Kingston Court. Tony is a member of JNP, is author of Zionism During the Holocaust, which was mentioned by Ilan, and he will speak for 12 minutes.
Holocaust Memorial Day was set up in, I think, 1999 by Tony Blair. It was a state, if you like, commemoration of the Holocaust, and it was, of course, for very specific reasons. Namely, Western imperialism has adopted a bastardized version of Holocaust memory in order to use it as a means of legitimizing its own colonial and imperialist ventures. So, for example, the US Holocaust Museum in the United States, I visited it very early, just after it opened in 1993 or 4, it was, and they had Pastor Niemöller's saying on the roof or on the ceiling. You might remember it. It starts off with, "At first they came for the communists." Well, of course, they changed that. Communism wasn't in fashion in America, still isn't. So that wasn't part of the saying, which was illuminated as you looked up at the museum. Likewise, the whole history of American immigration quotas has also disappeared, as it has British immigration quotas, because it's not convenient to, if you like, draw parallels between what happened to Jews in the 1930s when we didn't see the police supposedly concerned about anti-Semitism, and that today I have in my book, actually, a very interesting statement. It was by Anthony Eden, who was the British Foreign Secretary at the time. It was to his American counterpart in 1943, January 1943. And he said, there is a possibility that the Germans or their satellites may change over from the policy of extermination to one of extrusion, an aim, as they did before the war, at embarrassing other countries by flooding them with alien immigrants. In other words, they feared
the fact... This is for me to hear them. I hear them.
They feared the fact...
I would like this on, so it's not in here.
I think Suzanne is, yes, has now found a voice, so hopefully she will be able to join and speak after me. So the hypocrisy of our rulers beggars belief, but I said about this webinar, I called it a denazification of Israel, because Israel is unlike any other settler colonial venture. I mean, all imperialists have always seen themselves as victims. I mean, the British Empire was called by Rudyard Kipling the white man's burden. The American settlers saw themselves as victims of religious persecution in Britain. But the Afrikaners also, of course, had their experience in British concentration camps, concentration, not extermination camps. But no settler colonial venture has ever seen itself as a victim of extermination in the way that Zionism is. And this is, without doubt, their most effective and powerful propaganda tool. And I think that's why it is important to concentrate on the fact that Zionism never had not only no problem with anti-Semitism, but many Zionists, including Chaim Weizmann, welcomed the rise of Hitler. They saw it, and not just Weizmann, Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, they saw it as a golden opportunity for the Zionist movement to triumph in the Jewish community as a precursor to triumphing in establishing a Jewish state. And they were right to do so, in a sense, because Hitler, in many ways, was almost the founder of the Jewish state. During the 1930s, the number of Jewish immigrants to Palestine doubled and gave them a critical mass. Without that critical mass, it is doubtful whether a Jewish state could have come into being. It could well have gone the same way as South Africa, where the whites were in too small a minority to actually conquer the land. But the rise of the Nazis stimulated emigration, not only from Germany, of course, but from Poland and elsewhere in Europe. So, I mean, the Zionists had everything to be pleased about, which is why they deprecated attempts to save the Jewish refugees, because that would take away attention from their own enterprise. So I think we do have to draw out, and contrary to the IHRA declaration, which says it's anti-Semitic to compare Israel with Nazi Germany, I think we do have to do that. And the first place to start is, of course, the beginning of the genocide or the Holocaust in Gaza itself. We had Yoav Gallant, people may remember him, when he said, "Hello. I have ordered a Hello. Complete siege on the Gaza Strip. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed." This was similar to the hunger plan that the Nazis drew up. And they have followed it ever since. They have completely destroyed the ability of Gaza to produce its own food. 70% of the agricultural land, more than 90% of the cattle, more than half of the sheep and goats herds have been killed. And three quarters of its orchards have been destroyed. That was a UN survey in September 2004. And as I said, they have deliberately dug up the agricultural land in order to prevent people growing anything. And as a final reminder, of course, they have banned Gazan from going into the sea and fishing. So there's not that alternative source of food then either. So I think we can say, I mean, there are many, many quotes I could come out with. I'll just give you two. Avad Barashi, a well-known producer for Israel's far-right Channel 14, went as far as to proclaim the need to introduce gas chambers into Gaza whilst calling for a Shoah, a Holocaust. On the 1st of August last year, Shimon Elkabet, the chairman of the Israeli Film Council, urged the extermination of Palestinians. It's just like using a lice comb, which was exactly the comparison that Hitler made in Mein Kampf, between the Jewish bacillus and the lice and the Jewish people. And you can see there are so many quotations one could make that it is almost superfluous to try. So that, to say that the comparisons between the Nazis and Israel and Zionism is anti-Semitic is actually to say that anti-Semitism is simply factual, that it's based on truth. And if you say that, then I think you are anti-Semitic yourself. So we have to be quite clear that Zionism is a reflection of anti-Semitism, which in many ways took on its features. And the most important thing for Zionism is that the Jewish Holocaust is unique. There are no comparators. And the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, which is in charge of the events today, it calls what happened to the Jews a Holocaust, but for everybody else, the Roma, the Sinti, the disabled, it is Nazi persecution. It is not a Holocaust. The word Holocaust is reserved for Jews. And that, I think, is a taboo we have to break. We have to say Gaza is a Holocaust and not beat about the bush in any way when we say that. And I give the example of the Los Angeles Museum. As we know, one of the lessons of the Holocaust is never again. But for Zionism, never again means never again for Jewish people. It doesn't mean never again for every person. It was quite amusing in a way. The Los Angeles Holocaust Museum decided to post a graphic on Instagram, and it had the message, never again can't only mean never again for Jews. And there was an absolutely furious backlash against that, so much so that they took it down, this meme, within a couple of days. And they posted instead an apology. And it said, we recently posted an item on social media that was part of a pre-planned campaign intended to promote inclusivity and community that was easily open to misinterpretation by some to be a political statement reflecting the ongoing situation in the Middle East. They can't even refer to Gaza. That was not our intent. And they promised to do better next time. In other words, Palestinians are excluded from never again. And it's not just the Los Angeles Holocaust Museum. Yad Vashem was approached by 50 scholars very early on in the genocide and asked to condemn it. And they absolutely refused. Yad Vashem is the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Israel. And Yad Vashem has consistently refused to condemn not only the genocide or what's taking place, it's consistently refused to condemn any form of Israeli racism at all. It's established barely, I think, a quarter of a mile from Deir Yassin, the massacre of the village in 1948. But that is never, ever mentioned by Yad Vashem. And the same goes for every single Holocaust memorial organisation worldwide. The Holocaust Educational Trust in Britain, run by a woman called Karen Pollock, stated in the papers that it was shameful, no less, to compare Gaza to the Holocaust. So this is the Zionist lesson and this is the Zionist message. And that is why, in many ways, I wrote my book, because I think we do have to show the clear linkage between what happened in the 30s and the 40s and what is happening today. I think Zionism can only get worse, that Israel, I think, in the end, will completely collapse from its own contradictions as it races to the far right. And we can see who its friends are today. Donald Trump, Tommy Robinson was a guest of honour of the Israeli government, and so on. So the idea that it's an answer to anti-Semitism is, of course, absurd, because the biggest single factor in anti-Semitism worldwide is what Israel does when it claims what it does to be in the name of Jews. I've probably gone over time already, so without any more further ado, I will finish and say I do want this tradition of having an alternative Holocaust Memorial Day webinar to continue. And there's over 350 people here. So that is a really great thing. So thank you very much for listening to me. And hopefully we can now hear from Suzanne.
Suzanne is a child Holocaust survivor from France, and we're very happy to have you with us and to hear you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Okay. The Second World War was a colonialist war. However, for the world's peoples, it was a fight against racist fascism. The last 2.5 years brought the Palestinian struggle against Israeli apartheid into full view after more than 75 years of oppression. The Nakba, like the Jewish Holocaust, could no longer be denied. I was born in France in 1941 into the Jewish faith and landed in the arms of socialist parents. They rejected Zionism as a settler colonial project. Tony Greenstein, in his book, Zionism During the Holocaust, discloses close Zionist alliances with the German Nazis. Zionism is the terror that makes Palestinians pay for the crimes of the German Nazis. Zionism has criminally injured the Jewish people by conflating Zionism, the genocide of Palestinians, with Judaism, the religion. Before she was killed in Auschwitz, my mother was an activist in the Jewish resistance. She made plans to assure my existence. I survived thanks to the solidarity of a whole community in the south of France. Their love of humanity protected thousands of Jews and others fleeing the Nazi dragnet. Today, Jews of conscience surviving the Holocaust and their descendants profoundly feel the sacrifice of the Palestinian people. It is no wonder that Jews are in the forefront of the mass demonstrations wherever they live, challenging the U.S.-Israeli war machines. The battle cry rising from the ashes of the Holocaust means for us, never again for anyone, especially not the Palestinians, as the genocide is done in our name. Recently, U.S. imperialism, aided by Israel, blatantly revealed the ambitions to possess, exploit the natural resources, subjugate and rule not only the Middle East, but also in South America, beginning with the theft of oil resources in Venezuela. The U.S. colonists have huge plans for the world, all in the name of capital, placing their profits over the needs of humanity. We must keep demanding peace for Palestinians and for the immediate access to shelter, food, and health care. At the same time that we struggle against the spreading of colonialism, at the same time that we demand democratic rights for immigrants, striking workers, and democratic rights to expression in our own countries, where Israel's ruthless police tactics are used, we must show the connection with the genocide in Palestine. Palestinian flags should be present in all our demonstrations in acknowledgement that the struggle is one, global and interconnected. Against colonialism, against racism, against fascism, against imperialism. The millions of people globally who resolutely pour into the streets with determination for peace and justice have had a great impact in building solidarity and pressuring our own complicit governments and the reluctant United Nations. We possess powerful means that were used by the peoples of the world to end the rule of apartheid in South Africa. Boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS. We need to utilize this non-violent tool of defense, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, to strike at the global corporations. Their profits should be redirected for the benefit of humanity and the natural world. Thank you very much for allowing me to be part of this wonderful panel.
Thank you very, very much, Susan. I'm so happy that we've made it with you and that we heard your important voice. So, Stephen, welcome after all this time. Excellent. Yeah. And I'll just invite you to speak. We will continue the Q&A immediately after Stephen's contribution. We're very lucky to have the whole panel. I'm very pleased that that happened. Stephen, hang on a minute.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good.
Stephen okay. is also a child survivor from Hungary. He is an architect and an artist. Stephen, please give your presentation.
Yes. I would like to start, if I may, Chair, with the first and third stanzas of a poem by Miklós Radnóti, the great Hungarian Jewish poet and victim of the Holocaust himself. He was called up into a slave labor detachment of Jewish men attached to the Hungarian army, at that time allied to the Nazis. His is a warning and a cry from the heart from the dying days of World War II fascism. And it goes like this. In such an age I dwelt on earth, when men had fallen so beneath their nature that they, unbidden, for their lust would kill, and foaming, stagger in tangles of confusion, possessed by tainted creeds, bewildered by delusion. In such an age I dwelt on earth, when he who would protest perforce must hide and gnaw his fist in bitterness and shame. The nation in its madness laughed and thought it good to taste such fatal horrors, drunk with filth and blood. It was March 1945, and Radnóti was shot near the Austrian border at the end of death marches a few days before liberation. This was one of his latest poems, found on his exhumed body, bloodstained. But by the time of discovery of his body, I have been liberated by Soviet troops for about a month. I survived by hiding since October 44 on false name and papers, and pretending to be a Gentile in homes ran by a small rescue group of Protestant churches supported by the Swiss Red Cross through that very brave, resourceful envoy, Friedrich von Born. The rescue group was led by the great humanitarian pastor, Gabor Stelo. I was lucky to be living in Budapest with a Jewish population of about 200,000 because large-scale deportations were delayed due to Western pressure on the Hungarian government by a threat of saturation bombing of Budapest and by request from even the Pope Pius XII to the Hungarian fascist regent Admiral Horthy. But Eichmann, based in the Buda Hills, not far from our hiding places, was diligent, and 400,000 Hungarian Jews from the countryside by June 44 were transported directly to Auschwitz. 15 members of my extended family died with them. Only two teenager girls came back. The story of Ilonka, one of the two, is worth remembering. She was from the south countryside, staying in Budapest with my aunt Erzsi. Time came in the summer of 44 to return her home, and Aunt Erzsi took her to the station. When they parted and Ilonka was about to board her train, the marauding fascist Arrow Cross detachment caught up with her and asked for her IDs and immediately arrested her just for being a Jew and transported to Auschwitz straight away. My Aunt Erzsi was paralyzed witnessing this from a distance, unable to intervene, as she herself would have been arrested too and sent directly to Auschwitz. Aunt Erzsi came back from this trauma and suffered a hysterical nervous breakdown, which I clearly remember witnessing. Later, it was the same Aunt Erzsi who saved my life, as she, acting as a Red Cross nurse, was in charge of my small group of boys on false papers from October 44 to February, March 45. During this period of hiding, as an additional misfortune, we fell into the front line of fighting. In fact, it was the epicenter of the German-Hungarian last stand against the overwhelming Soviet forces in the Royal Castle area. Our bases were repeatedly destroyed over our heads or were, in other ways, ordered to relocate under fire several times, sometimes at night. Why is this particularly important for me now? Due to witnessing the multiple hazards, the siege conditions, total destructions locally, uncertainty, searching for safe alternative destinations, lack of water, electricity, food at times, while also in constant danger of discovery, affected, I think, increased greatly my capacity of empathy with the sufferings and struggles of Palestinians everywhere, but particularly in Gaza. apart from the obvious physical violence and suffering that we all see, I better understand and feel the invisible attendant sufferings, the lasting traumas. Sad to say, my dear Aunt Erji, who saved me and a few others, ended her days after 1956 joining her son, my cousin, in Stockholm, Sweden. She was a deeply unhappy person at that stage and finally committed suicide. No one can tell how much the World War II trauma contributed to the tragedy. And no one can tell us the amount of love and care of the surviving Palestinian brothers and sisters will need after the horrors of the genocide. And there is nothing more sickening than Israel and the Zionists exploiting our World War II Holocaust suffering to justify their own present-day genocide. I was sickened when watching a session of the United Nations Security Council when it was the turn of Israel's ambassador, who before starting theatrically fixed a yellow star on himself. I had to wear a yellow star as a 7-year-old and protest against the cynical exploitation of that humiliation to justify Israel's genocide. For me, the Holocaust experience demands that never again do any people such horrors anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Stephen. I'm so happy that you made the impossible happen. Now, I will start the Q&A in the order that the questions were asked. We have not a lot of them. The first question is from Abe Chaim. He doesn't say who he is asking to react to it. How can we prevent the Holocaust Remembrance Memorial to be built on the Embankment Gardens, which is only to be about 6 million Jewish victims? You understand that he's against the fact that the non-Jewish victims, who are the majority, will not be commemorated by that building besides the parliament. Who of the panel would like to relate to that? Anyone? Rada?
Yes, look, I've been aware of this this issue for quite some time, and the local residents in Westminster have been very dead against it. And I support that. I think there is no call whatever for a monument to commemorate anything, whether it's the Holocaust or whatever, in a small park on the banks of the river. I cannot, but we know what this is all about. This is pressure, Zionist pressure, in order to, further the project, which says you must think about the Holocaust day and night, etc. So I'm dead against it. I fully accept what the speaker says.
I didn't quite catch the question. But
The question was about the building of the Holocaust Memorial near the parliament, and the fact that it commemorates only the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust rather than the many others who also died in it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an outrage. I mean, arguably, the first victims of the Holocaust were the disabled, the mentally and physically handicapped, and their extermination took place from October 1939 onwards, the so-called euthanasia campaign. And not to remember them, not to remember the gypsies, who are also included in the Nuremberg laws, makes it very clear what the purpose of this building is, or this monument is. It's not to draw any lessons from the Holocaust, but it's to enable those who supply weapons to the current Holocaust to somehow paint themselves in saintly clothes. I mean, it's therefore a complete outrage. Unless you draw the lessons from the Holocaust, which is that you don't feed genocide, you combat it, then it's absolutely useless having such a monument. And so we have all these Holocaust memorial organisations around the world who refuse to even mention the word Gaza. They say it's political. Well, the extermination of the Jews was political as well, but they don't refrain from mentioning that. So it is an entirely cynical exercise in order to benefit imperialism. It's not about what happened. And we know the German government is the most fierce opponent of the Palestinian cause. It's the second largest supplier of weapons today to the Gaza Holocaust. So the only lesson they've drawn from one Holocaust is to perpetrate another Holocaust. And let's remember, the German state has never seen a Holocaust or a genocide which they haven't smiled upon. It started with the Herero Nama massacres in Southwest Africa, when the same person, Eugen Fischer, who experimented on Africans, then went to be the director of the Frankfurt Anthropology Institute in Germany, where he trained people like Dr. Josef Mengele, the chief SS doctor at Auschwitz. And there was the Maji-Maji rebellion and a genocide in East Africa, which is not so well known. And then there was German involvement in the Armenian massacre or genocide. So Germany is very used to these things. And of course, it will then suppress opposition to it. But the memorial in Westminster, I mean, given it's been approved by Keir Starmer, I think that says everything that needs to be said.
I think also I wanted to mention, to remind people, that the most important book on the Holocaust is Raoul Hilberg's history of the European Jews' destruction, destruction of European Jewry. In the beginning, in the first chapter, Raoul Hilberg enumerates the people who died in the Holocaust, 5.5 million Jews, and more than 5.5 million Soviet prisoners of war. So actually, the majority of people who died in the Holocaust were Russian and from other republics of the Soviet Union, who are never mentioned in any commemoration. Is there anybody else of the panel that wants to relate to that question, or shall I pass to the next one? Okay, the next one is also about a group of people that is not mentioned, and in a sense, some of you have related to this. This is an anonymous questioner. Why do the Roma people rarely or never get a single mention in the Holocaust Remembrance Days? Who would like to start?
Well, I mean, I'll just make a short contribution. I don't think that's true. I mean, I attended a webinar this lunchtime run by the University College Union at Sussex University, which was about the Holocaust of Roma and Sinti. So I think what you mean is the mainstream Holocaust memorial organisations. And the Zionists fought bitterly. Yehuda Bor had a famous debate with Sybil Middleton of the US Holocaust Museum when he said, well, no, it wasn't a genocide or a Holocaust because they were being persecuted because they erased social or criminal elements. And Sybil Middleton came back and said, well, that is the classic type of racist stereotyping. So the Zionist argument, of course, is that Jews and Jews alone experienced a Holocaust, but no one else. In fact, the Nazi attitude to the Roma and the Sinti was identical to that of the Jews, and up to 1 million of them died. But why? Because it's political. And also what the Nazis did was a continuation of the existing discrimination against Roma in Germany itself and, of course, elsewhere in Eastern Europe. And so it was normal, in a sense, what they did. There was nothing exceptional about their discrimination until it came to extermination.
Now, I will continue with some of the questions. We might not be able to share all the questions with you. There are two questions to Radha Karmi. One of them is, Radha, please say more re-Holocaust survivors not being deemed the right kind of Jew when they got to Israel. I think also Ilan might want to say something about that. Radha.
The many of the Holocaust survivors who arrived in Israel thinking that it was going to be this haven, this refuge for them, found that they were not well treated, they were looked down on. Many of them are poor, they live in poverty, and what I meant by saying the wrong kind of Jew is that they brought with them what the Nazi, what the Zionists, as a Freudian slip, what the Zionists would have regarded as a shameful history of being subjugated by the Germans, of being willing sacrificial lamb, that they just accepted their fate. They didn't fight back. They were not the new powerful, strong, wonderful new Israeli. That is what I meant. I don't know if Ilan wants to add to that.
Ilan?
Yes. Basically, I think Radha said it all. I just would add that many of the Holocaust survivors were interned in camps known as the displaced person camps, the DP camps. And we know from a very good research done by an Israeli historian, Yossi Grudzinski, that most of the Holocaust survivors who were in the displaced person camps did not wish to go to Palestine and actually wanted to go either back to their original countries, and many of them wanted to go to the United States. And he exposed in his book how the Zionist emissaries in the displaced person camps agitated against any Jewish organization such as the Joint that was about to help Jews from Europe to arrive in the United States instead of Palestine. And one of the tricks that the Zionist emissaries had was to enlist Jews in those camps already to the Haganah, the paramilitary Zionist organization. And by that, creating a situation by which that if, in case you didn't emigrate to Palestine, you actually deserted the military organization. That was just one of the method. As for the treatment in Israel itself, indeed, as Radha said, they were the antithesis to what Zionism was all about, which was creating the new Jew, very much an Aryan Jew, so to speak. And they represented the kind of life, as they would call it, in exile, And a very strong feature of Zionism was the denial of exile. And therefore, they were maltreated, mocked. They even used sometimes the term soaps, talking about them, namely reminding about the fact that the Nazis produced soap out of people's hair and so on. And until very, very recently, the government did not provide them the necessary help. What is important to remember is that Israel wanted very much to get reparations from Germany. I think Chaim mentioned it in his opening remarks. Wanted reparations from Germany, not for the sake of the Holocaust survivors, but in order to build an economy and a military to continue the dispossession of the Palestinians. So I think Rad and I covered it pretty comprehensively. Yeah.
Can I add from the chair that both of my parents survived Auschwitz and did not want to go to Palestine, like most of the people that Ilan mentioned. On arrival to Palestine, they found that the language they spoke as Jews in Poland before and during the war, Yiddish, was basically more of a banned language. The only printed material that attracted 100% of a sales tax was paper printed in Yiddish. Yiddish was a banned language. It wasn't allowed to present theater plays or films made in Yiddish. There were some very famous Yiddish players, Yiddish comics, and Yiddish filmmakers that survived. And they couldn't show their work at all because it was in Yiddish. I don't want to take more time. There is another question. The question we had answered now is by Peter McKinney. Kieran Tierney is asking, what advice do you give to people who are accused of anti-Semitism when they speak out against the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and are horrified by the apartheid they have seen? And, he says, what do you say to governments who have introduced the IHRA definition, often without consulting the people, which seems to be aimed at suppressing legitimate criticism of Israel? Any of you that would like to start answering this?
I don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the answer is quite simple, that we all know what anti-Semitism is. It's hatred or hostility or prejudice against Jews as Jews. It's very, very simple. And that's what anti-Semitism was traditionally understood as. But of course, Israel's apologists wanted to define themselves as the collective Jew. And therefore, they devised something called the new anti-Semitism. And that is manifested now today as the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition. But you can't be anti-Semitic against the state. Racism affects individuals. It doesn't affect states. So it's a complete nonsense. And the IHRA in practice is not about traditional anti-Semitism against Jews as individuals. It's about protecting the Israeli state. So 7 of the 11 examples that are used mention Israel. So we should be quite clear that when they talk about anti-Semitism, what they mean is anti-Zionism, an opposition to genocide, opposition to racism, opposition to all the things that Israel does is not anti-Semitic. And indeed, if you claim it is anti-Semitic, then what you're doing is associating Jews with Israel's war crimes. And to me, that is anti-Semitic. So the IHRA itself is an anti-Semitic definition, but it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism as most people understand it now and before. Thanks.
Anywhere else
Yeah, can I just add just a few words? Of course, everything that Tony says is correct, but the real key to this is the fact that the Zionists managed to make a conflation between anti-Semitism as hatred of Jews, as defined by Tony, and criticism of the State of Israel. This is no mean achievement, really. We really have to we have to understand that. It's become not only has it made people wary or nervous of saying anything against Israel in case they're accused of anti-Semitism, but it's muddied the waters. People don't and no longer know what anti-Semitism really is, but they think that anything to do with Israel, if you criticize it, then it means you're anti-Semitic, and that's a great achievement for the Zionists.
Anyone else that would like to join? Stephen, just a second. Yes, Stephen. We can't hear you. I think you need to unmute yourself.
Sorry, yes, I just want to say that I agree with Rada that in practice, although it's not needed, and Tony's right about that, but once it has been employed, it has been a most pernicious and dangerous tool of weaponization of anti-Semitism against individuals and generally creating an atmosphere or sphere in lots of areas. And I think now that Zionism is morally totally destroyed, undermined, and destroyed in moral terms, but not in actual influence, unfortunately. I think it is time to have a pushback, a counterattack on this definition. I think it is still being used widely and with great damage to individuals and institutions. And remember that Mamdani in New York State just canceled the definition which was previously introduced. So I think we ought to do something similar, a wide front counterattack against this definition.
Thank you, Stephen. Rana, did you want to speak?
So I actually, well, I have to go shortly, but I kind of wanted to follow up with a little bit of just a question that I find myself struggling with, of how to deal with recently, and well, after the last 2 years, but because people who are in charge of these sort of mainstream Jewish institutions, at least in North America, have done such a good job of wrapping Zionism and Judaism together. I mean, you see them at always giving these speeches saying that they're one and the same. Especially with, you know, with their IHRA definitions and these sorts of things, and calling people anti-Semitic for criticizing Israel and saying that's essentially criticizing Judaism. At some point, it becomes really hard to combat that, and you have increasingly people believing. I think especially like younger people coming to the conclusion, because that's what they're being told, that Israel, Zionism, and Judaism are all like one and the same. And so I don't know. I'm just curious. Like, I think that's more prevalent now than it's ever been, to such a degree that like it's quite hard to combat. And I'm just curious others' thoughts on how far that phenomena has come. I mean, where you've got just Jonathan Greenblatt blatantly saying like Zionism is Judaism, and if you don't believe that, you're not a Jew.
Can we have someone from the panel answer, Rania?
I think that there's a generational issue here in among Jewish communities. Chaim and I participated in the, I think we call it the first anti-Zionist Jewish conference. Radha was with us as well, of course, I remember, and in Vienna. And what I noticed is that some of it is generational. Namely, if you look at the American Jewish community, there is a new phenomenon in the last 2.5 years where young American Jews do not only disassociate themselves from Zionism, but they think the best way to manifest this new moral approach they have towards Zionism through being very deeply involved with the solidarity movement with Palestine. Nobody has done statistics of how many there are, but I remember Norman Finkelstein saying that compared to previous years, this is quite phenomenal in terms of how many young American Jews are now declaring themselves to be disassociated or disassociate themselves from Zionism. I think very much like France is the only exception, I think, in that respect. In most cases, in most Western communities, there is a difference between the official spokesperson for the Jewish communities, people who are part of institution, representing institution, who very much adhere to the point that you made, namely Zionism is Judaism, and attack on Zionism is attack on Judaism. But if you go to the, you know, to members of the Jewish community who are not organized necessarily, who probably also don't every moment of the day define themselves as Jews, it's probably even less important for them to define themselves as Jews, only when they are confronted with this issue of Palestine, they don't share this institutional position. In fact, I think it's a trend. I think especially in the United States, Israel is going to have to rely more and more on Christian Zionists than on the Jewish communities. After all, Mamdani was, let's face it, Mamdani was elected in the largest Jewish city in the world, which is even larger than Tel Aviv. So that tells you something about trends among young Jews, Jewish voters in America. This is a clear manifestation of something that's happening. And the last word is that I think there's a dialectical thing here. Israel has not yet completed its full transformation into a genocidal state, unfortunately. What I mean by that is that the Western world, the Western media rather, and political system still hang on to this idea that these were terrible 2.5 years, but Israel is coming back. The Israel they can tolerate is coming back. That's why they call it war and not genocide. We are after the war. And after the war, there is peace. And after the peace, there is a peace process. So we are back to the Israel we can tolerate as the West. I think they have no idea what's going on inside Israel. They have no idea about the social, economic, and cultural transformation that, regardless of what goes on in Gaza, continue. And they actually, this transformation had begun before the 7th of October 2023. Israel is becoming quick, in a very accelerated pace, an openly fascist, non-democratic, racist state, not only towards Palestinians, but also towards its own Jewish population. And this is something that would be very difficult to digest for those Jews who are very elastic in their approach to Israel. Namely, every time they found a justification why actually what we are watching is a policy and not a problem with Zionism, it's this particular prime minister, it's this particular government, this will become impossible to defend in such a manner. You will have to face the state that is probably a nightmare, even for liberal Jews, even for liberal Zionists, I mean. And this is something that is ongoing every day in Israel. I visit the place a lot, and I don't think you can see it from the outside. I don't think you can see it on the outside. But from the inside, you can see the rot. The rot is in the foundation. That explains the huge emigration of those who regard themselves as liberal Zionists out of Israel. They buy one-way ticket. They have no intention of return. This is a proper emigration of the people who constitute the cultural elite, the academic elite, the economic elite of the country, of the state. All of this, I think, would show that this equation that you're talking about, Rania, among Jews, I think would be far less evident in the future. Unfortunately, of course, this is not good news for anyone who lives in Gaza or the West Bank or Haifa, because part of the manifestation of this continued fascization of the state, the first victims of this process are, of course, Palestinians. Therefore, we have to find an urgent way of stopping this. But if we are not, at least we are witnessing a process that I think has a more positive I would say, scenario in it, but in the long future, unfortunately, not an immediate one.
I'd Thank like you. To say a few words as well, if I may.
Hang on.
I mean, the first answer to this, of course, is that when Zionism, the idea of Zionism equals Judaism, when Zionism first came on the scene, the most vehement opponents of Zionism were actually the Orthodox Jews. And until 1945, the majority of Jews weren't Zionists. So that is easily debunked. Secondly, I agree with Ilan when he says that what we're witnessing is the beginning of the end of the Zionist project. But as in South Africa, it is the final stages which are the most bloody. And we're seeing that now with the settlers having gained a critical mass and their representatives now being in the leading positions in government, Smotrich, Eliyahu, Gevir, and so on. But I don't think we should be in any doubt that although the leadership of the Jewish community, certainly in Britain, but elsewhere, is vehemently pro-Zionist, I think the majority of Jews are far more liberal. Certainly all the opinion surveys that have been conducted by the Institute of Jewish Policy Research and others have tended to show that. But of course, the leadership positions have been captured by the Zionists, and you won't hear that message. I would say roughly one third of Jews now identify as non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, and that is certainly a turnaround. But of course, anti-Zionist Jews like Ilan, myself and others on the panel are invisible. And the reason for that is quite simple. Imperialism wants a moral legitimacy for what it is doing in the Middle East. Israel is its attack dog. And that is nothing unusual. When the British Empire was in being, we didn't say that we were conquering India and exploiting it because we were literally draining it of every single rupee that we could lay our hands on. We said it was our civilizing mission, that we were there to combat sati, the burning of Hindu wives on the funeral pyres of their husbands. That's always been the case. Imperialism always needs a moral legitimacy and reason. The difference today, of course, is we have a lunatic in charge of American imperialism, namely Donald Trump, who doesn't even bother to disguise that he wants to grab Venezuelan oil or Greenland's natural resources because he's a transactional businessman, as he says. So in a sense, American democracy is also being stripped bare as well. But at the end of the day, Jews are the excuse. They're not the reason. And people, I endorse entirely what Rana said, that Israel does not control the United States. We are not seeing a new global Jewish empire, as David Miller said. It's got it completely about face, as it were. Israel is a small country. It has very few natural resources. the American imperialism controls what is happening, and it funds and supports that genocide because Israel projects Western power in the region. Israel is there to defuse and to counter any Arab nationalist revolution or uprising. And that's why I think we need to see what's happening in a context. For the Palestinians to be free of Zionism, they also, in conjunction with the Arab people, need to be free of the horrific regimes that are over them. And not only Iran, I mean, I do think it's a vile regime, but the Saudis, the Qataris, the Gulf Sheikhdoms, the Egyptian police states and so on, all of those are imperialist satellites to one extent or another. And Iran's great crime was it challenged Israel for hegemony in the Middle East. That's what the real reason for opposition to it is. It has nothing to do with nuclear weapons, because, of course, Israel has them already. So I do think we're seeing the beginning of the end, and I hope maybe to even live to see that end. I don't know. It depends how long I live and how long it takes. I can't predict it, but I do think we should look on the hopeful signs, even in the midst of genocide in Gaza, which, of course, is beyond horrific. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony. I think we've passed our 2-hour marker. I want to end this meeting by thanking the most incredible panel. There are maybe tens of messages on the Q&A, because that's the only way people can actually write back to us today, saying how informative and useful this meeting has been for them. So thanks for all the panel members for their efforts to be with us as well as speaking. And we are lucky that you all made it. I want to invite the chair of JNP, David. David, can you hear me? David Cannon is the chair of JNP, and he will say a few words to end the meeting.
Thank you, Chaim. Heartfelt thanks to both Professor Chaim Breshis and Tony Greenstein, both members of JNP Steering Group, for organizing tonight's webinar, both important authors in their own right. Thanks also to the esteemed speakers, especially JNP patrons Stephen and Ilan. Thanks to you all for attending. The speakers have made clear that Israel is a colonial project, not a Jewish project. Since 1948, there has been a slow burn genocide, the vicious cutting edge of Western imperialism. The UK state is determined to silence any opposition. Both Chaim and Tony have been arrested for supporting Palestine and opposing the decades of violent Zionist Israeli settler occupation. Tonight has been the most recent of a long series of webinars, which we record and make available on JNP's website. On the website, you'll find that we support boycott, divestment and sanction. We support the convivencia, living together as equals, and the one democratic state. JNP is a Jewish-led anti-Zionist UK organisation. We promote equal human rights for all and welcome members of all faiths and none who agree with our principles, which are available on our website. Use the website to join, to donate, to watch webinars, share the webinars, and find out more about what we stand for. Also, we have a Facebook page for news, events, and analysis. Please visit, like, comment, and share. And finally, please remember, midday this Saturday, another national demonstration assembles in Russell Square. Please support in any way you can both the Palestinian cause and JNP. Thanks again and good night.
Thank you very much, David. I think we will close now. Good night to you all.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.